Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Pete.
I'm Ben. And welcome back to The Henson Perspective, where today we're talking about the Edgar Bergen episode of Season 2, which aired for the first time in New York City on October 7th, 1977, 45 years ago today. Edgar Bergen was a huge influence on Jim Henson. He was in the Muppet movie just before he died, and it was released just after his death. Henson attended Bergen's funeral as one of his pallbearers. Their relationship is intertwined in terms of influence, and Henson, I think, giving him an international stage with this episode was probably a longtime dream come true.
Yeah, Edgar Bergen died 51 weeks to the day of this airing.
Mm.
He passed away on September 30th, 1978. So pretty shortly after this aired.
We're probably going to cut this out. He doesn't look like he's in ill health in the episode.
No.
In fact, we've had other guests who have seemed more fragile and immobile in terms of how they interact with being on stage.
Yeah, it's not part of my quiz, so we can talk about it. He retired, was doing a going away show, and then fell ill and passed away within like 3 days of kidney disease / failure. I mean, he was 75, 79, somewhere around there.
Your father would say that's young.
Yes, it's true, he would, but he's an 80-year-old man.
he would also have said that for the last 20 years.
It's true. I mean, it's not old, but Edgar Bergen doesn't look like a 79-year-old of today's standards.
Doesn't look like Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
Doesn't look like he could punch you out.
I thought he was significantly older. Mm. From this.
Well, we're going to talk about Edgar Bergen later in the episode once we've done the quiz that you've crafted for me.
Yes. So I have a pitch for today,
mm-hmm.
which is there's an A plot, a B plot, and a C plot for this episode because...
So we normally have an A plot and a B plot. The A plot is whatever's going on with the guest star, and we've basically put our cards on the table that we're excited for this season because the B-plot will be whatever's happening backstage, but that it will intertwine with the guest in some way.
Yes, and with this episode, there's a C-plot, which is the chicken plot.
The chicken plot sounds like a very strange B-movie.
Yeah, it's the prequel to Chicken Run.
Okay.
So there's enough chickens in here that I think we should just talk about the chicken stuff first thing, and then we'll do the quiz, we'll get into the A and B, and then we'll finish with the rest of the show after that.
Well, you know how much I enjoy fictional chickens and film chickens, so I am hardly going to say no to that proposal.
Excellent.
When do the first chickens show up on the show?
Kermit introduces them.
So right after the opening number, and he's come in front of the red curtain to say, this is an Edgar Bergen episode.
Yes, because he says they'll try and coax Mortimer Snerd out because he's a country boy.
You see, Mortimer is a shy country boy. Hey, Mortimer, this opening number should make you feel right at home. Ready, girls?
Which is T.R. Rooster conducting a chicken choir.
So this is, if I recall correctly, two chickens in the back row on elevated nests, and then four chickens on a platform in front of that, with T.R. Rooster front and center. T.R. Rooster being puppeteered by Jerry Nelson, doing wildly enthusiastic takes to camera over the course of this number, which is Babyface. Babyface, which was a number one hit in 1926, and when Little Richard covered it in 1958, it only made it to number two. Can't hold a candle to the original.
That's double. That's 100% worse.
And has been covered innumerable times, including by Julie Andrews in the 1967 film Thoroughly Modern Millie. But right before this, and the main thing that I found on Wikipedia that gave me an indication as to why it might have been in the public consciousness, was that there was a 1976 disco remix of this, but also it was used in the pilot episode of the Brady Bunch Variety Hour. So this was, weirdly enough, back in heavy rotation the year before this episode came out.
I think this might possibly be the best musical number the Muppets have ever done. I loved it. I'll never stop loving it.
And I don't want to dissuade you from that. I think perhaps I would pitch a quarter of Quandary in order to make a decision as to whether this or the other Chicken musical number are in my favorites. The other one is so simple and elegant that it really tickles my fancy. But
this one's way better.
Well, what this has as to its advantage is the orchestration of the piece, the way in which with each verse it goes up a key, so that the two lead chickens who are singing it start having to balk with increasingly screechy tones, really increases the dramatic tension of the song.
There's nothing on the fandom page
as to who plays what chicken,
but obviously top left chicken is Frank Oz. Because that, at the end, it's just Piggy. It is just Piggy singing.
This song is on the second Muppet Show album in a place of pride and deserves to be 100% one of the best songs that is going to come out of this season and be immortalized on vinyl.
I also have a note, because we talked about this a few weeks ago, about the difference in directing.
Yes.
This was a Philip Kasson episode.
It was.
And this had a number of insert shots, specifically this sketch. There weren't a ton throughout the rest of the episode, but this number...
This is actually cut in such a way that it helps amplify the dramatic tone changes that I was talking about earlier. Like, it focuses in on the chickens singing to each other and zooms in on... I mean, first of all, that allows the performers to potentially mess up a performance and not have to worry about it, that you can have those insert shots. But also it does help give a little bit of focus on the performances as they're getting shriekier and as they're getting higher pitched. You can feel it a little bit because you're right up with the hand.
Yeah.
Well, I can't, as I said, deny anyone's love for this number. It is one of the strongest openings to the show. I'm sure that as an honorarium to Edgar to have such a wonderful bit be so strong right out of the gate, I'm sure Jim was very happy.
And it was such a good number that the audience was going crazy, and the audience was all chickens, which is a shot we saw in the Rich Little episode.
So let me ask you, because I assumed that that was the case, but the second you started saying this now, I was wondering, wait, does that mean that T.R. Rooster is both in the second row of the insert shot of the audience and conducting the number up on stage?
Yep. He sure is.
So this is why that shot was available for the Rich Little episode, is because they decided to... I swear this wasn't intended to be a pun, to egg them on.
Except that was 204 and this is 207.
Oh, okay.
So that already existed, and they probably just went, you know what? If there are a bunch of chickens in the audience, they'd probably love this sketch.
Okay.
I think we should talk about Statler and Waldorf now, because Waldorf says, why would they have a bunch of chickens sing Babyface?
And the response to that is, because the alligators were sick.
Simply because we're talking about chickens, we should keep talking about chickens.
Then we go backstage and Kermit is surrounded by the chickens. He's congratulating them on the number, saying it's good, but at the same time, they're complaining to him about the dressing room, which is an interesting reversal, much in the way in which the surreality of the alligators in the previous thing just sort of comes out of nowhere. This is a great comic idea that the chickens complaining about the dressing room, that sounds like a thing where they'd be like, our dressing room is terrible, we want a better dressing room. But what it turns out is they're asking to be put in a chicken coop. They don't like being in the dressing room.
And Kermit says he'll see what he can do because you don't want to fight with the chickens union. They have a very strong union.
And solidarity forever. If I didn't love the chickens before, discovering that they are a potent workforce together, well, then I'm doubling down on my chicken support.
We'll return to this in a little bit because right. After the chickens leave, Kermit meets with Edgar and Charlie. So we will come back to that.
There is a parade of chickens in that number, but we're going to talk about it mm-hmm. in context.
And towards the end of the episode, the chickens come back and play another musical number.
Now, this is the one that I said I sometimes think is more interesting because you have the piano, the standard Rolf piano on stage, and a chicken comes out and starts pecking out a tune with his beak hitting one key at a time. And it's very simple, sparse music. And a second chicken observes this and then starts playing the melodic counterpart to this with their beaks going up and down in a contrapuntal way. And then two more chickens join in. So basically, you have this very amusing, jouncy, up and down song that is basically being done by two pianists with one hand and one finger each, pounding out this daffy little melody, but it's being done with hard chicken beaks instead.
I'm not saying I don't like it. I'm just saying Babyface is way more interesting. This is fun, and the note I say is, I could watch chickens do anything and enjoy it. Here's where it loses points.
Okay.
There's one note where no chicken's beak hits.
And you can still hear the piano
and
playing.
The piano clearly makes the note.
So you're basically saying that because of your standard dislike of Electric Mayhem problems, where you can tell they're not really playing the notes, you're dinging this.
There's a performer who missed his note, and I'm sorry. Babyface is better.
Whereas I'm going to say, obviously, most of the music that's ever done in The Muppet Show is done to a pre-recorded or partially pre-recorded track. Those hard plastic chicken beaks on those miniature plastic keys would be making sharp clacking noises every time they hit it. It's good.
It's good.
It's amazingly choreographed, but also the fact that they're working to a track and have scrubbed the real sound of performing is a thing that we're glad of, because otherwise it would be difficult to listen to.
Yep. Should it another take.
There's a lot of stuff in the Jones biography of Henson and in the Christopher Finch of Muppets and Men where they talk about the fact that Jim is a perfectionist and created a community of perfectionism, where the Muppeteers were very frequently like, I blew that take, let's take a look at the replay, I want to make sure we get it right, and that they did long hours in order to get things as good as possible. I'm sure they did many, many, many takes of this. And the fact that one note is missing.
Hey, Ben, I'm a one note kind of guy. Singularly focused.
I know you're a one trick pony.
Also true.
I didn't think necessarily you were a one note samba.
Last thing about the chickens is Statler and Waldorf are like me and hate the act. I don't hate the act.
But as they're saying how much they hated it, a huge chicken appears in the box behind them, making a squawking, growling noise, and they very quickly reverse their opinion.
Mm-hmm. It's fun. I would also be intimidated by that chicken. So, that's it for the C-plot.
Well, C is for chicken. That's good enough for me. So I feel like we've covered what we need to about the C-plot.
So let's go to the Q plot, the quiz.
Q plot.
Nice. I'll log that in the spreadsheet. Since that's the first one of the season.
It's true. There was a little thing in the memoir of a Muppet writer and reading about the dismissal of Burns that led me to believe that that kind of catchphrase-oriented writing was something that he was bringing to the table, and that we're probably not going to see it again, because I think it was one of the things that he felt the show needed to hang itself on as a structure, was that people had repeated phrases and that people had almost memes.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that the Jerry Jewell-led writer's room is going to move away from that considerably. And we may not see a cute cute ever again because of the lack of Burns in the writer's room.
Well, we're 4 episodes in.
Yep.
Haven't seen one yet. There's still half an episode to talk about. There's none in this episode either. But I'll keep it a column for it on my spreadsheet, and I'll let you know.
But, as you said, you were going to quiz me
on our guest. So, Ben, at the age of 9, he traded a set of tin soldiers for a magic lantern, a possession that altered the course of his life. Within a year, he had created, by playing with this toy, a private world in which he felt completely at home, he recalled. He fashioned his own scenery, marionettes, and lighting effects, and gave puppet productions of Strindberg plays in which he spoke all the parts. Now, Ben, you might be saying to yourself, Pete, that wasn't a question. And you'd be correct. It was a statement. But was it a statement about A, Edgar Bergen, B, Ingmar Bergman, or C, Bergdorf Goodman?
B.
That is correct. Yes, that was about Ingmar Bergman.
My favorite superhero.
Yeah. Edgar Bergen started learning ventriloquism at the age of 11 from a pamphlet called The Wizard's Manual. After his father died when Edgar was 16, he then went out to work as an apprentice, accountant, a furnace stoker, a player piano operator, and a projectionist in a silent movie house. Question number 2. This one is a question. Which one of the following was not mentioned or the subject of a comic book? A. Edgar Bergen. B. Ingmar Bergman. Or C. Bergdorf Goodman.
B.
You are still correct.
My favorite superhero is not the subject of a comic book.
No, he is not. But Edgar Bergen, in 1938, Western Printing Company published a one-shot of Edgar Bergen Presents Charlie McCarthy, a 36-page comic book that has a current value on eBay of $1,275. In the August 1984 issue of Secret Wars number 4, on page 14, panel 4, Janet Van Dyne talks about Bergdorf Goodman.
And that counts enough.
Herman Bergdorf and Edward Goodman, I believe.
Okay.
Have entries
with Edward Woodward.
Yes, not be confused with Iwawu. Have entries in the Marvel Wikia fandom page because of this entry.
Very cool.
Question number 3. All 3 subjects have ties to radio, as Edgar Bergen rose to fame as a ventriloquist on the radio, and Ingmar Bergman wrote and directed many, many radio plays. And 2 have ties to Orson Welles, but which subject is contradictorily simultaneously credited with helping curb and also stoke panic for Orson Welles' famous radio play War of the Worlds? A. Edgar Bergen, B. Ingmar Bergman, or C. Bergdorf Goodman?
A.
That is correct. It was Edgar Bergen. He was a frequent guest on the Chase and Sanborn Hour, and he was scheduled to be the guest on October 30th, 1938, the night of the War of the Worlds broadcast. Many Americans tuned into that instead of Welles' War of the Worlds. However, he's sometimes blamed for stoking the panic because when the Chase and Sanborn Hour took a musical break 12 minutes into the hour...
That's when people turned back into and didn't know it was.
And yes, and they hadn't heard the preface of, this is a radio play, blah, 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 and heard the news, quote, unquote, and thought, what's happening? Question number 4. All 3 of the subjects have connections to the greater Muppet universe, and therefore have pages on Muppet fandom. Whose page is the longest? Edgar Bergen, Ingmar Bergman, or Bergdorf Goodman?
Bergdorf Goodman.
No, unfortunately, it is also Ingmar Bergman.
Okay.
Edgar Bergen's is 331 words, Ingmar Bergman's is 692 words, Bergdorf Goodman comes in at a paltry 91 words.
I sort of assumed because of Piggy Fashion there would be a lot of Bergdorf stuff.
Nope, it basically just talks about the best Muppet scene of all time, the makeup counter scene with Piggy and Joan Rivers in the best Muppet property of all time, Muppets Take Manhattan.
Your editorial bias is noted for the record.
Thank you. Ingmar Bergman's is so long because he worked with a lot of Swedish Sesame Street actors.
Huh.
And was also parodied by The Muppet Show in a later season and many other Muppet properties over the years. And Jim Henson also quoted Bergman in Henson's film Youth 68. Question the last. Let's talk about season one guest star, Candace Bergen, and her relationship to these three subjects. One of the connections is obvious. Today's guest star is her father. She's appeared in a feature documentary about one of our three subjects. Is it Edgar Bergen, Ingmar Bergman, or Bergdorf Goodman?
Edgar Bergen.
Incorrect.
It's Bergdorf. I'm going to flip this table.
Well, looks like you better get a new table because she is second billed in the 2013 documentary Scatter My Ashes at Bergdorf's. So yeah, I did research on three separate entities for this, because all week long I've been incorrectly saying Edgar Bergen as Ingmar Bergman and went, what's the third? Yeah, that was the other thing that I was thinking about doing, was because Kermit introduces this show as we have multiple guests.
Right.
I was really trying to figure out a way to not do any questions about Edgar and only doing questions about the dummies. But I then came up with this little game.
I'm seriously impressed. The dummies are, of course, something that came up in the Candace episode, and they each have an individual personality. Charlie McCarthy has a monocle and a very nice suit and is a snob. And Mortimer Snerd has freckles and a shock of hair and a big curvy nose and is a hick and a goof. And I never thought I liked Mortimer Snerd, both because of the hayseed voice and because of the look of the puppet. But I was surprised how much I think I preferred the Snerd segment of this than the McCarthy segment.
Yeah, for sure. I think also partially, similar to what we were talking about last week, the Snerd segment is more integrated to the Muppets, where the McCarthy segments seem to be more of just them doing material that exists and then Muppets are there.
I agree, particularly during the... So let's talk a little bit about what Bergen and his puppets do with the Muppets so that we can then talk about the successes and less than successes of those two particular segments.
Mm-hmm.
As we mentioned, after the Chicken Union holds their wings in solidarity in the air and wanders off, the camera pans to Kermit walking in front of Charlie McCarthy and Edgar Bergen, who are waiting backstage. And then they have a long back and forth of McCarthy doing his snob act, of being dismayed to be on the Muppet Show, of being dismayed that their host is a frog, thinking he's a toad, generally being insulting. And not having seen Bergen McCarthy acts, to my knowledge, prior to this, the he's my secret mean selfness of the act made me understand a lot of why ventriloquist acts get turned into supernatural horror, of the basic idea that you get to have your id, you get to have your worst impulses come out of the puppet. I don't actually think Bergen probably was that negative of a person.
Not according to Candace, as we've talked about.
Yeah, that there were issues there in terms of his coldness as a parent. But the jokes are fairly flat in terms of him being an insult comic.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have any real edge to it. It's just that Bergen comes across as such a avuncular, jolly person that the him sort of being like, oh, Charlie, you're so mean.
Kermit, I do forgive Charlie. I know that he can be difficult and trying.
Yeah, I can be difficult without trying.
It didn't light my fire, but I at least got that that would be an text for the larger concept of ventriloquist dummies breaking bad.
Mm-hmm.
But it also meant that it didn't really endear me to either Bergen, who's letting McCarthy say these terrible things to Kermit, or McCarthy, who's just sort of wanly being like, I don't like anything, but without any particular edge to it. He's not like, to mention another angry puppet, like Triumph, the insult comic dog, where you know that he's just angry at everything and that's kind of the fun. The pissiness of McCarthy didn't warm me to him.
I think that's partially because the Muppets are so warm and welcoming and inviting and all these other good characteristics. So to have a guest basically not want to be there and insulting them constantly, it butts against our expectations. It doesn't work with them.
And so that leads us into the first musical number that's performed with the guest, which is a performance of Consider Yourself from Oliver.
I would say performed around the guest.
Good point, because that also reinforces what you're saying in terms of they're not really joining in.
Yeah, and just, Charlie makes a couple of comments at the very end, but otherwise,
They sing, and he, whenever something happens, he comments on it. Whether the you have rows of chickens and pigs and monsters coming in, and each time they do, he basically says, well, they're trash. And he takes an opportunity to sort of comment on the lyrics as they happen.
Consider yourself part of the furniture.
Not me.
There isn't a lot to spare.
So what? Who cares?
Whatever we have to share.
But the basic number, Consider Yourself, is a welcoming number. It's, we're inviting you in to be part of our merry band. And the fact that it doesn't thaw McCarthy, it doesn't work. He gets to the end of that song and later in the show, and he hasn't changed or grown. I get that from the perspective of a term they would not use of 1977, of the IP-ness of Charlie McCarthy, that you wouldn't want him to grow or change as a guest on this variety show. That would be a bad idea because the character has to stay the character.
But it doesn't even look like, you're right, Charlie doesn't warm up to any of this or anything like that, but he is engaged the whole time. He's constantly looking around. He's looking at whoever's singing. It's really fantastically done by Bergen. But Bergen himself is kind of staring.
He's mostly watching Charlie.
Yeah, or not. He's not looking at the Muppets. He's just not doing anything.
Now, there's lots of anecdotes from Henson appearing on talk shows, and he brings out the puppet, whichever he's playing at that particular time, and he talks about how the puppeteer almost becomes invisible when the Muppet is on his hand. And you do have that amazing thing of very quickly you'll have Johnny Carson talking to Kermit, and you'll sort of forget that this weird hairy man is right there behind him, moving his mouth at the same time, because the animation of the Muppet is so big and so broad, you can't help but be drawn to ignore what's going on in the background. I know anecdotally that Bergen downplays his skill as both a puppeteer and a ventriloquist, and there are a number of occasions in this episode where Charlie negs him and he puts down his own ability to effectively be a invisible or a perfect, you can't see my mouth move ventriloquist.
You don't know what you're saying.
Yes, I do, Bergen. I can read your lips all.
Which I have a note about that. So as I mentioned in the quiz,
yeah,
he was a guest on the Charlie and Sanborn Hour. He was so frequently a radio guest. And for the fact that the whole point of a ventriloquist is that there's a puppet, he would bring it to the studio and do it in live, but the audience didn't care. They couldn't see that, and they ate his acts up.
Yeah.
So I think that's also part of the reason why he's not that great at it, is because he largely didn't have to be.
Mm.
And they already loved him, so then when he was performing live for people, they didn't care that they could see his mouth moving because he was Edgar Bergen and that was Charlie McCarthy.
I just think it's interesting that what Henson talks about is a virtue, that the puppeteer disappears into the background, you're sort of saying is a criticism of Bergen, in that all this stuff is happening around him and McCarthy's doing great work and Bergen's just sort of there and you're digging him for it.
Because it's billed as Edgar Bergen is the guest star.
Mm.
If it was billed as Charlie McCarthy solely and his friend Edgar,
isn't that just the conventions of a post-TV Guide world where everything's done in the simplest, minimalist? I mean, Kermit says, we have two great guests today. We have Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. As far as Henson and Kermit are concerned, they have two guest stars and they're hoping to get a third.
Mm-hmm.
The simplicity of putting it in a track name, a menu item on a DVD, or a listing in a television guide, you want it to be as simple and direct as possible. That may not have been how the Muppet Show wanted it to be advertised.
So should I, for ranking purposes... rank Charlie McCarthy and Edgar Bergen separately, because...
But then you'd also have to rank Mortimer separately as well.
Yeah, so I'm not going to do this.
Good.
But that is basically what I'm getting at, mm-hmm. is...
If you thought that McCarthy and Snurd were funny, then you, by extension, think that Bergen is funny. Because they don't exist without him.
It's true.
Even if he, but he's the man...
on stage.
Yep.
Even Jim if... Henson is not on stage.
Even if you think Bergen's performance as Bergen is a little wan, the puppets doing a good job means that Bergen is doing a good job.
But he's not, because he is not doing a good job. The puppet, which he, yes, you were right, he is controlling, but Bergen looks bored.
Hmm.
Or Bergen is...
He's abstracted a little bit.
Yeah, like I talked about in the Madeline Kahn episode, like, she sometimes looked off in the middle distance. He's regularly either, like you said, looking directly at Charlie, or he's, like, not really paying attention to the chaos that's happening around him. So, I initially criticized his skill at ventriloquism, but then I learned of the radio show stuff, and I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. I'm okay with that. But I couldn't get past the fact that he just didn't seem involved.
Well, I mean, they're your rankings.
It's true.
And you have occasionally asked me for input, but the truth of the matter is you have to put them in your order, and that is a thing that I can't tweak for you.
I do have one more note before we move on.
Yeah.
I also think something that our listeners should look out for, and I don't know if you noticed it, during the final moments of Consider Yourself, I think Scooter and Fozzie were being double puppeted by the same person.
Hmm.
And that person forgot which one was on which hand. Because they're doing the... And Fozzie sings and Scooter isn't. And then clearly Fozzie shouts, like the voice of Fozzie shouts, Consider Yourself. But Scooter's mouth moves. And... Fozzie is already singing, Consider Yourself. His mouth is open, singing.
I 100% didn't notice that. Well, that is, I will look out for it next time.
So I don't know if, because Frank doesn't do Scooter.
Mm-hmm. The fact that it was Fozzie's voice with Scooter's mouth made you feel like that's got to be the same person and they're doing the wrong hand with the sync track.
Yeah.
It's a good intuition. We started delving into the details of this not just because it was the time in the episode, but because I wanted to talk specifically about Mortimer Snurd.
Mm.
And that is the next segment with Edgar Bergen.
Well, before we move on, should we jump backwards? Because there is Edgar before this, which is the cold open.
So we didn't talk about the cold open.
There's not much to talk about, but in this week's Time Watch, Time to Curtain Watch, Scooter calls 25 seconds to the curtain.
Mm-hmm.
It cuts the curtain at 26 seconds.
So sometimes they're pretty right on.
Yeah, it was pretty close. I was pretty pleased with that one. But yeah, the Charlie McCarthy is scared, not of Scooter, but there's a Kuzbanian in the dressing room. That's all. So yes, the next time we see Edgar Bergen, we don't see Charlie McCarthy. We see Mortimer Snurd, and Fozzie comes into the dressing room to meet them.
Aside from my awareness of the visual of the puppet, which has been recreated, both of these puppets have been recreated for other people to use as their ventriloquist dummies many times throughout history. And so this particular pre-Jeff Dunham hayseed is sort of embedded in pop culture semi-anonymously. I think this is my first time ever seeing Snurd be Snurd.
He looked familiar to me, but I couldn't tell you anything. There are technically three Charlie McCarthy puppets.
Uh-huh. So there were three physical incarnations of Charlie McCarthy that he used for different purposes or over different times.
Yeah, over the time. But when he passed away, One, I don't have it anymore. I don't remember where I saw it. But one of them was sold at auction. One is sitting in a museum. And one was donated someplace else.
But this starts off with the basic premise that Snurd is an idiot. Being a hayseed, being a hick, he's not that smart. And the sketch begins right off the bat with him confusing Fozzie's name. In that
surely Mortimer should know
who Fozzie is. So Mortimer assumes that his name is Shirley and then gets corrected that it's Fozzie. And he says, oh, right. Yeah, Shirley Fozzie.
3 years before Airplane. Airplane came out in 1980. This came out in 1977.
Snurd is confused because he isn't sure.
Lee.
That he should know these things or not. And so he's confused as to whether or not maybe he's not there yet on the show.
Am I supposed to be here?
Well, of course!
Oh, you'll have to excuse Mortimer. He's a little bit slow. Yeah, it's probably why I'm not here. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a good philosophical wordplay joke.
But I liked the fact that he was secretly clever mm-hmm. in that the game of this is that everybody else gets confused by him understanding a little bit more than he thinks he does. And so at the very end, the line is that...
Listen, Mortimer, take my word for it. You are here.
Well, thank goodness. Now, are you through? No, I'm here.
Which is such a brilliant punchline.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very impressed with the writing of this. This struck me as it could have been a routine.
Oh, yeah. It
and instead of, you know, whatever guest host on a radio they did this with, they did it with Fozzie. It won me over. Particularly because of the kind of sweetness of Snurd. Not just being an idiot, but being an idiot savant instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a nice twist. Also, we should mention Fozzie's there because he decides that he wants to be a ventriloquist this episode. That's going to be the B plot that we then mm-hmm. come back to in a little bit.
And so he's coming in to ask for advice from Bergen, but gets distracted by the presence of Snurd and then gets ensnared in the temporal mechanics.
He gets ensnared? You want me to stop showing up on Friday nights now, then?
No. I'm just wondering if, much like Mortimer not actually being here, if I can get Shane Carruth to get me to have never been here in the first place.
Well, you're in the prime position to figure that out yourself. Ben, there's a river right over there. You should just go upstream and color it.
That river's not over there. It runs through it.
That's not a Shane Carruth movie.
No, I'm moving the goalposts. There isn't a third Shane Carruth movie, is there?
No, it is just those two.
So, yeah, I kind of had to switch it up. To keep doing that would have been a time crime.
That's a Spanish movie. Very good Spanish movie.
Well, let's bottle this time conversation and come back to it later.
After that, the finale
mm-hmm.
of Edgar Bergen's segments is just another Edgar and Charlie doing their act. Although they are talking about various Muppets in this one, so it's not just a pre-written act. Mm. It's definitely tailored to this appearance.
But it starts off, because it's back to McCarthy, it starts off with the same vibe that the chat before Consider Yourself had. Of, mm-hmm. are you enjoying yourself? You know, how can I enjoy myself? There's nothing here to enjoy. And so it then returns to that sort of gray well of the guests aren't having a good time. This will come back later this season. There will be other guests who are frustrated to be on the show. I can't help but think that there's, again, I'm not intending this to be a pun, that part of the woodenness of the performance of the ventriloquist dummy is part of what makes it lie flat, because of the guest I'm thinking of who's frustrated and angry at having to perform and to be there in the first place, he gets very hot-tempered, and so that helps energize, whereas Charlie's sort of sniping.
Yeah, if Charlie got that hot, he'd catch on fire. Because he's made out of wood.
Thanks
and wood, for... And wood burns.
Gilding that particular lily there. But yes, we have a couple of Muppets who haven't really interacted with them come on. But also, this creates its own mini runner of the hanging joke of McCarthy saying he hasn't really interacted with a frog since he was in biology class.
Mm-hmm.
and the looming threat of the idea that either what he wants to do or thinks should be done to Kermit is to have him vivisected is the engine that this particular sketch operates on.
And then, obviously, once he gets to Miss Piggy, she is not pleased with what he has to say.
He was just saying that he wanted to meet you.
Uh-huh. Didn't sound that way to me.
Well, me neither, and I said it.
For your information, you overdressed Splinter. My heart belongs to Kermit.
And so she hits him. She does a classic hi-ya, but because he's made of wood, specifically oak, we learn, she hurts her hand, and it doesn't faze Charlie at all.
It is true that I think this, aside from the double hi-ya with Rich Little, this might be the first time that Piggy's powers of kung fu, or pork fu, to complete the alliteration, Piggy's powers of pork fu haven't really been all that effective. Normally she's good at using the hi-ya to win the circumstance.
We'll talk about this later, but not in this episode. Mm. She's 0-2 this episode. And then it cuts to the closing. This is what I don't understand.
Okay.
Charlie's afraid to be on stage with Piggy, but he's immune. I get that maybe he's scared of being hit again, but he shouldn't be.
Right. They decide to play it that he felt threatened by her attack.
And Kermit says she won't come on stage, so Charlie and Edgar do come on stage, say their goodnights, and Charlie again tries asking Kermit,
do you know what we did to frogs in biology class?
And Kermit just ends the show.
Which is the proper thing to do.
So let's talk about Fozzie.
Because Fozzie's emulation, I think this is a great thing for Fozzie to be, is a comic engine for him, is there's a comedian on the show, I want to do what they did to be successful. We're not necessarily doing Fozzie stand-up acts where Fozzie comes out and bombs now. He's not telling bad jokes. He's trying to learn how to be a good comedian, and he's falling flat on his face. And that kind of aspirational behavior where you want him to succeed, but also you don't, is a good switch for the character.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you still get the game of him not being good at it. It's not just the same thing heckling from Statler and Waldorf over and over and over again.
You can see that part of what's going on is that he doesn't understand what he's doing, or he has a misconception of it and he's misapplying it. And that's what happens in two different stages in this backstage bit, where the first is that he brings out the dummy as he's talking to Kermit about what he's going to do for his act.
Yeah, he needs supplies to finish the dummy because he's only partially constructed at this point.
The dummy is got a paper mache balloon head and goggly eyes, and starts off at this stage bald, and therefore clearly in need of some of the construction materials that Fozzie is looking for.
Is the puppet's name Chucky?
Yes.
Which is almost Charlie.
But is definitely Chucky.
Also true, yeah.
Long before Child's Play comes into existence.
Also doesn't look anything like the My Buddy Doll.
No, but true.
It looks more like Fozzie than...
Yeah, I don't really think he has a bear quality to him. But
no, but he's got the same nose and the same eyes, and the flesh color is a slightly different brown than Fozzie's orange brown. Mm. So it's not a one-to-one, but it's close enough. And then in the second section, once he has been finished with
he's got fuzz, blonde curly hair taped to his head underneath a hat.
He has eyebrows, too.
I think he's designed to look like Harpo Marx.
Okay.
Because the gag in the second bit is that he doesn't talk.
Right.
And Harpo Marx doesn't talk.
Oh. I mean, it's revealed at the end of that Fozzie doesn't understand that he's supposed to be doing the talking for the puppet.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't get the Harpo Marx thing. I was just like, oh, Fozzie didn't understand the difference between Edgar and Charlie.
I think it's slim, but the hair and the hat is kind of a Harpo archetype, and it's a stretch to say that that is the definite.
But it's also not that far off from Fozzie's hat.
Yep. Anyway, I'm planting a flag in that interpretation that's a meta joke. As you say, he brings him out on stage and tries to get him to do classic two-man joke setup punchlines.
Who is that lady I saw you with last night?
Is that me?
Appropriate.
But Chucky isn't talking, and Fozzie gets increasingly frustrated and even upset at the idea that he can't get Chucky to talk. So Kermit has to come out and explain to him, and Fozzie is absolutely astonished by the knowledge that the ventriloquist is both the voice of himself and the dummy.
Yeah, he never hits the dummy, but he shakes him real good.
So much so that the hat and the hair and almost all of the things that he needed to add to him since the first appearance fall off.
Yeah. Finally, once being told, mumbles the joke because he's not a trained ventriloquist.
And so he does the thing where he's most interested in not moving his mouth, so he reads Chucky's lines in such a way that it's like he's holding his lips together.
Which is really well done because he's a puppet, so you just had to not move the mouth of the puppet. But they still, they scrunch it and they move it just like, it's really, really well done. And then Fozzie leaves him on stage.
Well, yes, having delivered his one joke punchline badly, Fozzie does the Fozzie thing of celebrating his victory early and runs off stage.
And then Chucky does come to life and delivers a good tag.
Actually, I spent the night alone.
Again, good roots in this for scary ventriloquists.
Mm-hmm. And that's the B-plot.
Yeah, Chucky never comes back. He's just in those two sketches. But it is, I like the fact that it entwines with the Bergen stuff.
Absolutely.
And so not only did I think that the Mortimer Snerd was the best interaction and the best delivery of Bergen's jokes, but to then have Fozzie want to emulate Bergen, talk to him, fail to get the right information that then results in this being a wonderful disaster helps elevate the Bergen-ness of it, and it works better because of the way it loops in and out of the Bergen appearances.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's talk about the things we haven't talked about yet.
So we're going to do a full rundown of everything that happens in the episode, and then we will close with statistics, with the opening of a Lego minifig.
Because we're four episodes in, we have a definitive winner, listeners. If you have been keeping score at home, I have.
And our five favorite moments from the episode. After the backstage bit with Scooter, the show opens with Kermit being very excited that Edgar Bergen is here. And as the normal opening musical theme plays, Statler and Waldorf's line is,
maybe this week they'll be funny.
Wanna bet?
And then we see George. He's not pogoing. Week four of Pogo Watch. Still no pogoing.
Yeah, for anybody who wants to prognosticate as to whether that changes and whether or not Pete's commentary will alter, we're taking bets.
Hey, here's a safer bet.
Yeah.
Do I get to week 24 on Bogo Watch? Yeah. It's happening every week.
Gonzo then, in the O of the Muppet Show, blows his trumpet, except we don't even get a trumpet noise.
It's just a gunshot,
and he gets knocked backwards.
Not quite an explosion, though, either.
No.
So I can't count it as an explosion.
Definitely not that kind of an explosion, but more of a ballistic report. Kermit comes out, introduces their two very special guests, and hints at the third, introduces the chicken number. And then we have the audience shot with the chickens who are on stage applauding, and Statler and Waldorf talking about alligators. The chickens come off stage. Edgar and Charlie make fun of Kermit as a lousy host for being an amphibian, and they sing Consider Yourself.
Then we have a Muppet Newsflash, which the announcement for this newsflash comes early.
It comes before the wipe.
Yeah, they're celebrating, the audience is clapping for Consider Yourself, and you hear, and now a Muppet newsflash, and then the diamond wipe happens. It was very weird. I don't think it's ever been that early before.
No, I don't think so either.
I don't know how I knew, but as soon as Dateline the Muppet Show,
the fact that the Muppet Show was the news item,
I knew that he wasn't wearing pants.
Speaking of prognostication.
Yeah. In my brain, I just went, I bet the joke is he's not wearing pants. And then guess what? The joke was, An embarrassing situation developed today when the Muppet News reporter accidentally went on camera forgetting to put on his pants.
And then he realizes that he's reading the report about himself, looks below the desk where we can't see anything, and then says, "Oh, good grief," and sort of sidles off. We then have Gonzo doing performance art, where he is, much to I assume your delight, in a wrestling ring.
Yeah, it's kind of like the pilot episode, which had the runner of the two Muppets wrestling. Yeah, you have Gonzo blindfolded, wrestling a brick.
And speaking of sonic changes, Kermit introduces this, but his voice is distorted like it's through
the ring announcer.
And it has the accurate sonic quality of this is being done at either a boxing or a wrestling match.
Also, just like the last Gonzo episode, you get full body Gonzo.
Mm-hmm.
You have a shot that's like at a 3/4 angle looking down. It's not at the ring level, looking through the ropes.
Which is good, because it helps establish Gonzo in relationship to the brick.
Mm-hmm.
The brick is said to be 6 pounds. I do not have any useful Google information as to what the average weight of a brick is, but that feels heavy to me.
Yeah, but bricks are pretty heavy.
Like I said, it feels that a brick should be 50% as heavy as the head of a 4-pound sledgehammer. Or, I'm sorry, 50% again that heavy?
According to U.S. practices, generally the weight of a brick is kept between 4.5 and 6 pounds. Standard size of a brick weighs around 4.5. For jumbo standard brick, it will be 5.9. Queen brick, 5.6. Roman brick, 4.7. And a huge size through wall brick weight around 42 pounds.
Well, I'd just like to say, 4 pounds I wouldn't have quibbled with.
So, yes, 6 pounds is big for a brick.
I think they just wanted the brick to be big enough so that when Gonzo wrestles it onto his chest and then finds himself trapped beneath it, for it to look like it could keep him down, it needed to be slightly bigger than a normal brick. And they were just like, yeah, 6. Why not?
Here's what I'll say. So, yes, the way the wrestling match goes down is because Gonzo is blindfolded. He's kind of feeling around. Eventually, he gets close enough to the brick that he can smell it. Which is when he picks it up and it falls on him. This match was more interesting and entertaining than the WrestleMania 7 blindfold match between Rick the Model Martel and Jake the Snake Roberts.
Knowing nothing about it, I agree. But why was it more interesting for you?
Because this was only 49 seconds long. Where that match went on for like 10 minutes of watching two men
blindfolded miss each other in the ring.
Yeah, blindfolded matches are the worst wrestling matches of all time. It's like watching two people play Marco Polo, but they're both have to keep their eyes closed. There is another audience shot, and the Guguru has glowing eyes again. I don't like it.
Pete, he is suffused with internal wisdom. After that, this is when Kermit is trying to get Pigs in Space going, and Gonzo comes out and complains that the brick was supposed to be welterweight.
Which is why it had to have been 6 pounds then, because that makes it a heavyweight brick if it's on the bigger size scale.
Okay.
So a welterweight is usually, it's less than middleweight, because usually the weight class scales featherweight, welterweight, middleweight, light heavyweight, heavyweight.
Flyweight, featherweight, right?
Yeah, but who cares about flyweights? Those are tiny boys.
I just wanted to show off I knew a little something about this.
I am proud of you.
Thank you, Karen Sisko. Then as he is trying to get Scooter to get Hogthrob on stage, Fozzie comes out to ask for the glue and other materials in order to make the dummy. As Fozzie leaves, we have one cutting insult, and in an episode where I've been making fun of Charlie McCarthy for his cutting insults, it's probably important for me to point out that Kermit says to the audience as Fozzie leaves with Chucky, the pre-named, we don't know he's Chucky yet, Chucky, he says, "There goes the dummy and his dummy."
But coming from Kermit, it works because we know Kermit cares about Fozzie.
Yeah, there's love there.
You can't bully my brother, only I can bully my brother.
We then have Pigs in Space, The three vocabulary words for our three cast are indomitable, flappable, and inexplicable.
I don't think we need to do the bonus points.
We don't need to do the bonus points.
Clearly I know what all those words mean.
I'll merely point out that flappable is, I think, what they think is funny, because flappable is what's called a lost positive or a vestigial positive. We almost never describe something as flappable. We only describe it as inflappable.
Mm.
And so that is them being like, that's funny that, you know, we could have done the inflappable first mate's piggy, but...
And stuck with the three ins.
Uh-huh.
Because that's initially what I didn't like about it. I was like, wait, no, just why not have three eyes? But now that makes more sense.
They're doing the word that doesn't really exist in the English language.
Mm-hmm.
This opens with the announcer telling us that the swine truck is on the verge of a hideous catastrophe.
And it's established that Miss Piggy is the only person who can save the swine truck.
Piggy is very excited to report for duty and take on whatever task will allow her to be the hero.
Which Captain Link Hogthrob informs her she's the only person who can operate the independent heating / unifying element across the horizontal equalizing plane.
And upon receiving this information, two pigs. There are more pigs on the swine track. There are anonymous BDI crew members. Bring in the independent heating / unifying element across a horizontal equalizing plane, which turns out to be a space age ironing board with a clothes iron on top of it.
And Piggy is none too pleased to realize she's just doing the laundry. Hogthrob and Strange Pork go to leave, and Piggy chases after them, kind of, and tries to hi-ya them with the iron in hand, but as the door closes, she hi-yas the door.
A little less starch in the pajamas, okay?
Yeah? Well, starch this, sausage snout!
So, Ben.
Yes?
Does that count as a hit?
Because she hits the door.
Right, she doesn't hit a person.
I think, in general, we've required somebody to be struck as opposed to something to be struck.
Cool. So, one hit this episode. Spoilers for the end of the episode.
That is our fade to black. Mm-hmm. The end of Pigs in Space, which means we come back to the UK spot with Rolf at a piano with a rose in a vase on top instead of the normal candelabra. And he sings Show Me a Rose, a song that starts with the introduction. There are so many songs about roses, and then the lyrics are supposed to reflect all the different songs in songwriting history and to comically reverse them.
Show me a rose and I'll show you a girl named Sam. Show me a rose or leave me alone.
I have since found out a little bit about the history of this song, which makes me feel like I should like it more than I did. I did not enjoy this performance, and I think I unfortunately have to blame Rolf for that. I think that he doesn't pitch it the way in which the song's originator does.
The note I have in my notes says, to no surprise, meh.
Did you look up where the song came from?
I don't know how I glossed over this in the Wikia when I was using it as help for my notes.
Mm-hmm.
Just learned it's a Groucho Marx song while you were talking about it.
Right. First appeared on a 1952 album called Hooray for Captain Spaulding and Other Songs. The fandom page wants us to know that this doesn't actually appear in any Marx Brothers movies. This was just created for the album. More recently than 52, it is one of two closing tracks on the fourth side of a dual LP called An Evening with Groucho in 1972, and was released as the title track in a 7-inch, with Lydia the Tattooed Lady as the B-side.
Oh.
So somebody thought that this song was pretty good. There are at least two appearances of Groucho performing the song on talk shows in 1971. And one of the introductions is very much people saying, we love it when you do this song. So this was kind of a hit for Groucho in his later years. And watching those videos, I get the vibe that Rolf wasn't able to pull off. Groucho deadpans it. Rolf is mugging a little bit. But in general, I just don't buy the comic reversals from him. For whatever reason. The undercutting of a rose is supposed to represent this, but it doesn't in this circumstance.
I don't find especially clever, period. But him not doing it super desert dry, I think, removes some of the punch.
Hmm. I think the rose looked nice. It was a very dewy rose.
They spritzed it.
Otherwise, as I already said.
Yep. Meh. From that, American audiences came straight back to the dressing room, where Fozzie lets himself in to ask advice from Mr. Bergen. And Mortimer Snerd does his clever reversal, much to Fozzie's confusion and chagrin.
Then Kermit introduces Fozzie's act, so he was really
working right up to the wire.
Yeah, he needed that advice and did not get it, and maybe that's why his act didn't go well, because Mortimer just did his thing. Then Fozzie does his act, as we already discussed, and then we have a scientist singing Time in a Bottle.
This is a Jim Croce number, which was on a 1972 album, and we've previously encountered Jim Croce on The Muppet Show in the Lena Horne episode, where she performed I Got a Name with the dog and the luggage and the train stop.
Yes, thank you. Now I remember, because I was like, I know that song, and now I can hear it. I remembered something then.
Yeah.
Took a lot of prompting.
And as you mentioned, the direction of the photography in Babyface, this also has really good photography.
Mm-hmm.
That begins with an elderly scientist behind a rack of
bubbling potions and
liquids and vials and Erlenmeyer flasks. And then he emerges from behind all that to begin singing If I Could Keep Time in a Bottle. And over the course of the song, he mixes the various chemicals and potions together in order to restore his youth. And he gets younger and younger and younger over the course of the abbreviated song until the puppet has been substituted to one of the kinds of Muppets that is allowed to consume things. In the earlier parts of the song, you have a fade as he tips a vial back. You have him mixing chemicals so that they're mostly foam and bubbles, so that when he points it towards his mouth, nothing actually comes out that is liquid.
Or if it does, it's just bubbles, and that's easy to scrape away.
It's very good sleight of hand. But for the final vial, he's definitely pouring a liquid down the mouth. And then there's an explosion, and he turns back into the old Muppet that started the song.
If I could save time in a bottle, the first thing that I'd like to do.
Then, why can't I hear Gonzo performing this song?
I don't know, considering it's Jim.
I know. I did not do this research myself because I wanted to ask this on pod. Have there been any other uses of this song in The Muppets?
According to my brief perusal of the fandom page in order to find out who wrote it, I didn't see any other versions of this.
According to the Wikia,
yep.
The original Jim Croce version of the song was used in a 2016 ad for the iPhone 6S featuring Cookie Monster.
So, I don't think that any of those associations could be the thing.
I just, for some reason, as it was happening, I could hear Gonzo singing it. So, but yeah, this was great. And really, really good voice work.
Mm-hmm.
Because not with every puppet, but maybe every other time that the puppet got younger, the voice also got younger. And
he,
then at
he
the
started
very
off
end,
scratchy and old, and then by the time you get to the third transformation of the puppet, he's doing his high head voice and sort of aging himself into a pre-adolescent voice that helps emphasize the youth of the character.
I looked around enough to know that you're the one I want to go through time with.
Yeah, and then when the explosion happens and he returns to the old, he goes back to the old scratchy, and it's really, really well done. And as you mentioned earlier, the direction, like there's cutaways, there's lots of different things here. So I was surprised when I looked after Babyface and saw that this was a Philip Casson episode and not our boy.
Mm. I think there's a possibility that Casson might be slightly more adventurous. Obviously, we're going to look for patterns in these things as we continue through the course of this series. But the work he did in the two prominent musical numbers of this shows that either for editing purposes or for emphasizing dramatic purposes, he seems to have a pretty great flair, and they're moving away from my criticism of the pig number in the first episode, which was almost no real camera work at all.
Yeah, just static. Either he's learning, or,
as you pointed out as a possibility of our wild speculation segment at the time,
heck yeah,
that because of production possibilities with that set, they may have not had time for any clever setups.
After Time in a Bottle, we have the chickens playing down at Papa Joe's, and Statler and Waldorf commenting on how much they hated it until being bullied by a big chicken.
Kermit introduces Edgar Bergen, and he comes out and discusses whether or not they're enjoying their appearance, and upon insulting Kermit, Piggy rushes to his defense and hits the equivalent of a wooden pole.
Then we have the closing with Charlie being afraid of Piggy from being immune to Piggy's hits.
And at the final of the three references to biology class, the credits roll hurriedly, and Statler and Waldorf close off the episode.
Well, it's just Waldorf who closes off the episode, because Statler's right. Not in that box.
That's right. He says he shouldn't have jumped.
As he looks over the edge for the third episode now of four episodes we've seen.
I really did stop and be like, wait, was there something I missed? Did I look away at a moment where there was some... Nope, it's just taunting us with, haha, content warning suicide.
Or maybe Statler was really scared of that chicken, because that's what happened the last time we saw them.
And that's it for the episode. I think we've hit most of the stats, but let's...
Speaking of hits.
Let's summarize what we talked about in the rundown and in the previous sketches for those who are keeping tallies at home.
Yeah, there was not a lot of categories to clock in this episode. There was the one hit, since we are not counting the hit of the iron against the door, and one explosion in Time in a Bottle. That was it. As far as music goes... Shockingly, not shockingly at all, lowest amount of music this episode, or so far this season. Only 10 minutes and 57 seconds out of 26 minutes, 24 seconds for 41.48%. So still over a third, but under half. That's the least it's been so far.
But that extra 40-odd seconds of chickens at the piano helped, because...
It was exactly 30 seconds. I did also count the intro to Pigs in Space, because that is a musical theme.
It is.
So that is in there as well. But yeah, not a ton. Really only five musical numbers with the 30-second pompages.
Okay, and for your ratings for our three guests in one, our holy trinity of puppeteers.
Well, I didn't like it. Not shocking, based off of my comments about Edgar Bergen looking detached, and also what we were talking about with Charlie being mean. Mortimer was a bit of a saving grace, but that was also largely pre-written, it seemed. So, and I really didn't like Consider Yourself, them just standing there. And it all happening around them. I thought Edgar's skill with puppeteering the puppets, or the dummies, was excellent. But overall, in terms of my typical factors for this, I rated him as 20th.
That was my guess.
There could be worse. I could definitely see him sliding down.
Wow.
So, yeah, I conservatively rated him at 20th, leaving him room to fall. I don't think there will be five worse guests than him pushing him up out of that, into the teens. But
I can't think of that many, but also there are several names this season that I don't recognize. And there are going to be episodes that I'm watching for the first time during this series of the podcast, so...
Which, speaking of another one of my regular segments, is what has been seen for the first time. And when this episode was aired on Nickelodeon, the wrestling was cut, and Statler and Waldorf being threatened by the chicken was cut.
That's interesting. I suspect that either or both of those is in the Muppet Treasure VHS compilations then, because I believe I've seen both of them someplace.
Fair. So,
but this also isn't the first time I've watched this particular episode. Mm. Because, but then again, I don't really remember the Mortimer Snurd bit, so maybe I didn't watch this episode in toto and just remember the things that were excerpted from it.
Could be. I think this is the first time we've wildly speculated about ourselves.
And if we don't know about us, who does?
I mean, I definitely don't know about us.
Well, it's the fourth episode of the podcast so far.
That is true.
Which means let's get a score update from the four quizzes.
Well, Ben, as I'm sure you're well aware, and listeners, as you probably are too, Ben destroyed me on these quizzes. He did very well in mine, and I did very poorly in his. So with a score of 7-2.
Oh, gosh.
Wait, is this golf rules? Lowest score is good? No? Ben wins. So, Ben, please open our first Lego minifig.
All right. So, in our mostly blank box, we have six packets. I'm going to choose from the middle.
Please be something I don't want. Please be something I don't want.
And we have Beaker.
Oh, I'm very mad.
Beaker's wearing a lime neon green...
That head is so good.
...suit, lab coat. He's carrying a classic Spaceman walkie-talkie from way back in Legoland, and a custom-printed meter of some sort that's registering way in the red for him to hold in his other hand. But the head, as you say, is the most custom piece of the minifig, and it's pretty extraordinary.
We've talked about this briefly off-air, but one of the things we discussed is as a final season-long prize, because there are six four-episode segments.
Correct.
But then as a prize for winning the whole season...
The ability to steal.
The winner will be able to trade.
To Yankee Swap.
Yes. One of their figs for one of the other person's figs, should both of us get any figurines throughout this season. It's a distinct possibility. Ben will just run away with this. But we'll find out.
We'll find out.
Because the score, quote-unquote, resets.
Correct.
Next episode. I will continue to keep track of the season long, but we will wipe the slate clean for the next four episodes. So, now that you have been awarded the very good minifig...
It's a strong start.
Oh, I'm so mad. Why don't you tell me your first favorite moment of this episode while I cool down a little bit?
My first favorite moment that I circled and starred as I was watching the episode that really jumped out at me before I did a second review to say, you know, what do I want to do, was Snurd's punchline of, maybe that's why I'm not here. I really felt like that was such a... I have previously indicated just how much I love the Going to Morrow song, and that kind of verbal temporal reversal stuff really is one of my go-to funny bone things. So I think that why I was like very eager to say this is. So for my number one, I really want to start with the thing that I thought was transcendent writing as the conclusion of the Mortimer Snurd segment.
For my first moment, our second moment, I'm going to cheat.
Oh, cheat, never peat.
I'm going to combine three moments into one moment. Because they all fall under the umbrella of the comic strip Peanuts.
I'm intrigued.
Twice in this episode, someone says good grief.
Mm.
Kermit says it when he discovers Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy in the backstage.
Good grief, it's Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy!
And then when the Muppet News Flash happens and he discovers he's not wearing pants, he says,
oh, good grief.
For the third, to make the pattern. This doesn't really work, but... In Babyface, on one of the inserts, when you get a close-up of the chickens, it looks like the two top chickens are doing the peanut dance. their wings are by their side, and their little legs are, they're not really going up and down, but they're kind of pogoing, and their heads go forward, and then their heads lean backwards, and that's my favorite dance of all time. It's the only dance I can do. Mm. And so the chickens doing the Peanuts dance and Two Good Griefs made me go, what's going on with Peanuts in the Muppet Show right now?
For the third of our five moments of the episode, I want to talk about, in the Fozzie and Chucky time segment, how good Frank is at his gradual meltdown of not understanding why Chucky isn't doing what he expected him to do. This is a puppet he has built. This is a thing that he has created, and yet he somehow expected it to become animate and participate, which gives you a potentially very weird insight into the world the Muppets inhabit as fabricated beings themselves, sort of, except most of them are animals, but sometimes they're bred. Like, what? He expected Chucky to be alive and talk to him.
Back to the chicken. Hello, Chucky. Say something, anything.
Fozzie.
He won't talk to me.
Yeah, well, listen.
And the quiet, sad anxiety with when he says to Kermit, when Kermit comes on stage, he won't talk to me, is so good. It's amazing line delivery, and well done, Frank. You put color in there upstream that none of us could have possibly anticipated.
Amazing comeback. Callback. So proud of you. For my final moment, our fourth moment, I talked pretty negatively about Edgar Bergen.
Well,
this episode,
you talked negatively about his physical presence while something else was happening.
It's true. And I suppose I'm going to actually talk about how good Charlie is. Mm-hmm. So I'm still not going to say good things about Edgar. But Edgar is the reason why this is so good.
Yeah.
In the first backstage segment, when Kermit claps back at Charlie about saying how he looks wooden, mm, and Charlie is offended, Charlie makes a sarcastic laugh. And he moves his head back and forth like...
If you're going to do jokes like that, Berg and I will see you right at home.
Just kind of wobbling. And it's not wooden at all. Mm. Because it's so believable that, like, that's exactly how I would have reacted to a bad pun making fun of me. I would have made that laugh and waggled my head the exact same way. And the stick that's the neck never is revealed.
Mm.
Like, he raises it up to the perfect depth where...
After years of practice, he knows where that seam is. That, yeah, you can't have the head go too far out of the body.
Yeah, and he threads that so perfectly, and it's so well done.
For my final moment, I would like to say that there are lots of good little reversals and clever bits of writing in here. I have to agree, Jim Henson, that I think getting rid of Burns was the right thing, and the color and the weirdness of the Muppet Show that we love really has started to establish itself this season, and the grace notes are absolutely what I think start to reveal themselves, that they have the throwaway lines is always what we tend to talk about in this segment, and the idea that the chickens have a really good union is such a great, weird concept.
I see what you mean about the dressing room. Yeah, I'll see what I can do about having a coop built for you out back, okay? Okay, okay, sure, right. You have to treat the chickens pretty well because they got a very tough union.
We have the chicken threatening Statler and Waldorf. Like, they're basically two sides of the same coin of why would you be scared of chickens? Chickens are omnipresently easy to conquer, easy, their food, they're not something that we're worried about. Well, on the one hand, you could have a really big chicken, but on the other hand, you could have collective action. They're basically two sides of the same coin of how do you make a chicken something that you actually would need to pay attention to instead of discount? And it's so smart to have both of them in the same episode, but all respect to the chicken union.
Now, Ben, what if the big chicken is just all of the little chickens Voltroned into one big chicken.
Then I'm even more in love with the fact that they can physically join together into collective action.
Yeah. It's the personification of unionization.
That earth, air, water, fire, and heart all come together to make sure that the chickens get their coop in an alley instead of being made to dress in a room.
When all those things come together, they are Chicken Planet.
Which is the sequel to Chicken Run after the prequel of...
Chicken Plot?
Chicken Plot.
Also, I'm going to cheat again. Jim Henson says treasure in Time in a Bottle, like treasure.
I'd save every day like a treasure, and then again I would spend them with you.
And I love it.
Yep, he's got a great accent.
Treasure. This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. Music in the episode comes from archive.org and archival Henson Associate clips of Silver and Cones, Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast to Sam and Friends.
You can find us at farstperspective.com and follow us on Twitter at @farstnamebasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan, Emily, and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic monomania.
All excerpts in this podcast are used for the purposes of review. If there are things, dates, facts, names, domestic appliances, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website, and we will post it to our errata page on farceperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest in contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben, and we'll see you next week when we discuss season 2, production episode 11, guest starring Dom DeLuise. Yay!